The following podcast has been paid for by Perched on the Top Rope.
Welcome everyone to Perched on the Top Rope. I am your host, former Dirt Sheet writer from Ringside News, Daily DDT, Sports Kita, and more. Ladies and gentlemen, I am Lee Walker, and today's show is all about the three-time WWE Hall of Famer, Bret the Hitman Hart. And I'm going to ask a real serious question here, and it's all about one thing. Is Bret Hart a bitter person? And we have to go back, and I mean, we're going to go way back, all the way to July 2nd, 1957, when the second generation Canadian star, Bret Sergeant Hart, the Hitman, was born. Now, Bret started training and wrestling as a kid and participated in amateur wrestling at Ernest Manning High School, and later at Mount Royal College. Bret got his professional start in pro wrestling in the 1970s in his hometown of Calgary, wrestling for his father's Stu Hart promotion, Stampede Wrestling. At first he was just supposed to be a referee, but fate intervened, and in 1978, when another wrestler couldn't perform, Bret got his first chance to compete. Nobody expected that quiet young man to become one of wrestling's biggest stars in the industry. From early on, Bret Hart showed a knack for making matches look genuine. And he once said, "No one could take a shit-kicking like Bret Hart." And that statement might sound blunt, but it tells you how much pride he took in making every slam, punch, and every hold look real. When Bret started wrestling for his dad, there wasn't one major league or organization. Instead, there was approximately 30 regional districts and promotions that were decades old with unwritten rules and agreements that prevented any one of the territories from poaching on others. And Stu Hart controlled one of those 30 regional wrestling outfits. But by the early 80s, the wrestling scene started changing and boundaries started to crumble, and larger companies bought up those smaller promotions. One of those biggest shifts happened in August 1984 when the World Wrestling Federation, the WWF, now WWE, acquired Bret Hart father's Stampede Wrestling. This allowed the WWF to reach far beyond its traditional borders. Earlier that year, Maple Leaf Wrestling out of Toronto had given in to the pressure and sold to the WWF. And it was just a matter of time before the WWF was going to control the Canadian market. Bret was among several wrestlers who were able to remain on and become part of the WWF after the purchase of Stampede Wrestling. The folks at WWF quickly identified Bret's star power, and over the next decade, he had won multiple championships, including the WWF Tag Team Championship as the Hart Foundation Tag Team, and then later as a solo star during WWF's Golden Era, which was 1980 to 1993. So during the Golden Era, the WWF had swallowed up most of its competitors and created its most popular stars that you might remember even if you weren't a wrestling fan. Names like Hulk Hogan, Macho Man Randy Savage, and another Canadian star, Rowdy Piper. And in the early 90s, the WWF started to find itself in trouble due to the doctors selling steroids and the allegations of sexual assaults occurring within the organization. WWF owner Vince McMahon was also indicted on charges related to the illegal distribution of steroids and alleged to have sexually assaulted a former performer. And at the time, Hulk Hogan was actually jumping ship to WCW and set to testify in the steroid scandal, and the WWF seemed vulnerable. Its competitors smelled blood in the water and tried to take advantage and take control of the American-Canadian wrestling industry. It's reported that during this time, Vince McMahon entrusted the future of the WWF to Bret Hart, who many believed was a safe set of hands. He wasn't in trouble outside of the wrestling ring. He was just a hard worker, and the fans enjoyed watching his wrestling. So for the next few years, Bret Hart was the main face of the organization. He had won the WWF Championship 5 times. His trademark spandex of pink and black, he represented his home country with passion, and he carried himself like a proud Canadian icon wherever he went. His brother Owen had just joined him as a wrestler on the WWF roster. And in late December of 1994, McMahon was acquitted of all drug charges, and the sexual assault case had fallen by the wayside. When he was able to return his focus to pro wrestling and the WWF, Bret was still holding down the fort, but WWF was in trouble. A number of big-name stars had been poached by the competitor World Championship Wrestling, including Hulk Hogan. Bret Hart stayed and helped keep the WWF competitive and kept fans turning in to watch its product, even though fewer and fewer of its big name stars were appearing alongside him. Now, the WCW had big money behind it thanks to Turner Broadcasting and kept aggressively trying to sign the top WWF superstars. The feud between the two companies was akin to Coke versus Pepsi battles, and we were used to seeing that in the 70s and 80s, but this rivalry went deeper than ratings. Some would say it was personal. Ted Turner reportedly wanted to squash the WWF because of a long-standing beef with its owner, Vince McMahon. And Vince had clawed his way to the top of the wrestling world by being a cutthroat and relentless competitor. And unfortunately for Bret Hart, he found himself caught in the middle of this tug-and-war as in 1996, the WWF owner Vince McMahon acknowledged Bret's value and signed him to an unusual 20-year deal that would, in theory, keep him in the WWF until he retired. It was a bit of a Hail Mary to try and stabilize the company and avoid losing Bret to the big money across the pond at WCW. But business is business, and things were getting rough for the WWF, and the WWF could no longer afford Bret Hart's massive contract. Reluctantly, McMahon suggested Bret see what WCW might offer him. And Bret did just that and signed a 3-year, $9 million deal offer from WCW, who quickly pounced on the chance to nab another one of WWF's biggest talents. Bret had been loyal to the WWF for his entire career and only decided to leave after McMahon encouraged him to do so because the money just wasn't there. And this was only long after many of his peers had already jumped ship. Now, Bret didn't jump ship until much later, where guys like Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Randy Savage had all jumped ship between 1995 and 1996. But before Bret could leave the WWF, there was a small matter of him being the WWF champion at the time. As custom when a wrestler leaves a company, if they were champions, they'd lose their title in the ring before departing. And that's where our story truly kicks into high gear. Brett didn't want to lose his championship in Canada and wanted to have a say in how he went out of the WWF. He also had some strong opinions about who he'd be willing to pass the title on to. Specifically, he didn't want to lose to his nemesis, in and out of the ring, Shawn Michaels, whom he was scheduled to wrestle in Montreal shortly before he was set to make the move to WCW. If you ever seen Bret Hart, you know he looks like a super serious dude. Always. Bret Hart didn't put up with silliness or, you know, over-the-top shticks. Hart always treated professional wrestling very seriously. He viewed it like an athletic art form, blending real technique with showmanship. Now, Shawn Michaels, on the other hand, he was more brash, with a flamboyant and edgy attitude and a knack for making enemies behind the scenes kind of attitude. And by 1997, the tension between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels was at an all-time high. Though most of it was all part of the act, the way Hart still talks about it now, it's clear that the two performers didn't care for each other that much. And things turned specifically sour when Michaels made an on-screen comment insinuating that Bret Hart had been romantically involved with female wrestler named Sunny. Bret felt that the joke crossed the line into insulting his family, so the two nearly came to blows backstage over it. While Bret signed onto the drama that came with the soap opera that was professional wrestling, his family didn't. Now, in 1997, folks, professional wrestling was just coming into the WWF attitude amongst the WWF Monday Night Wars. This was a time when that line between real life and the performance was getting blurred for most fans. Bret's integrity was something he refused to compromise. He didn't want his family to suffer because some people couldn't tell Shawn Michaels was just playing a character or not, and that Bret wasn't actually an adulterer. They were blurring the lines between storytelling and reality. So the rumors began to fly about how they fought in the locker room and parted ways, disgusted with each other. And wrestling works best when there's a bit of real tension fueling the storyline. And Bret vs. Shawn had plenty of that to spare. As a final show of respect, McMahon initially agreed to honor Bret's wishes and drop the idea of Bret losing this match. There would still be time before Bret went to the rival WCW for him to drop the title, and it didn't need to occur on Canadian soil. Hart's pending exit from the WWF was unknown to audiences, and Canadian fans were pumped that Bret Hart, who had become a national hero, was set to take center stage during one of WWF's biggest events of the year, Survivor Series. The event was being held at the Montreal Molson Center. It would become a night that fans, wrestlers, and even people outside of wrestling would never forget. As we now know behind the scenes, McMahon was worried about Bret Hart keeping his title past the Montreal event. And not too long before Montreal, a wrestler named Alundra Blaze left McMahon's WWF for rival WCW while still holding the WWF Women's Championship belt. And on WCW Nitro, she promptly tossed the belt in the trash can on live TV, which was damaging to the WWF's street cred and popularity. And Vince had feared that something similar might happen with Bret and the men's championship belt. It's a beautiful Eagle Wing championship belt. And though there was no evidence Bret would have done that, Vince McMahon was, in fact, restless during this time the WWF was so vulnerable. Meanwhile, backstage, rumors were now revealing that a handful of people were cooking up a scheme to force Bret Hart to lose. On November 8th, that night before Survivor Series in Montreal, Vince McMahon held a meeting with Shawn Michaels and some other insiders. They had hatched a plan to trick Bret during the match, and only a small inner circle knew exactly how it would go down. Some said WWE producer and on-screen personality Gerald Briscoe was involved, and some said another wrestler, who you might know to this day as Triple H, had a major role. Referee Earl Hebner apparently learned about it at the last minute, that if Bret wouldn't drop the title willingly in Canada, the paranoid cutthroat businessman Vince McMahon would make him drop it by any means necessary. When the WWF superstars showed up in Montreal, Bret reportedly got a warning from fellow wrestler Vader to be careful out there. And Vader said, Vince has a tendency to screw people in these types of situations. Bret had shrugged it off. He'd been wrestling for decades and believed he had earned creative control over his match outcome. He also trusted referee Earl Hebner, who had sworn would never cross Bret Hart. Now, the official plan, as Bret understood it, was that during the match, there would be a moment when multiple other wrestlers would run into the ring, which was a commonly scripted thing. And during this, a ref bump would take place, and they planned for the match to end in a disqualification. This non-finish would allow Bret to remain champion, so he could either forfeit the belt or lose it somewhere else after Montreal. And from Bret's perspective, he had a handshake deal with McMahon that this was the plan. But the real plan involved Bret losing during part of the match where Shawn Michaels was supposed to put him in a hold that sometimes makes wrestlers submit. This was Bret Hart's move known as the sharpshooter. When this part of the match took place, someone would signal the timekeeper to ring the bell. This would make it look like Bret had submitted, even though he hadn't. Michaels would grab the championship belt, and Bret was left fuming. And McMahon's problem would be solved. Not to mention, it would create a great storyline and might just be part of WWF's recovery. Now, the controversy might be good for ratings, but nobody exactly knew how Bret would react. They were about to find out, though. Oh, God, were they about to find out. So picture this, fans. You're in the Molson Center on a nice November night. There's over 20,000 fans, and they're hyped to see their hero, Bret Hart, defend the championship against Shawn Michaels. For Canadians, Bret's matches on home soil meant a lot. He'd built his entire year around being a proud Canadian. And this is at moments where they had like the 4-on-4 match with the Hart Foundation versus, it was 5-on-5, Pillman was part of it, you know, Shamrock, Stone Cold, Goldust, LOD. I believe Ahmed Johnson was in that match. And, you know, Bret had, you know, was taking down Canada from a step. This was after WrestleMania, where he had faced Stone Cold Steve Austin. And we saw the double turn, where Stone Cold Steve Austin goes from a heel to a face, and Bret Hart goes from a face to a heel. So we're seemingly working a Bret Hart as a heel. Shawn Michaels is supposed to be the good guy, but we're in Canada, so that's not how it's working. Bret's the good guy no matter what. Well, the match started like any typical Bret and Shawn showdown. There was the intense brawling, technical wrestling, and a lot of heat from the audience, who booed Shawn quite a bit. Now, Vince McMahon stood near the ringside, which is unusual, adding an uneasy vibe for the show. And at around the 19-minute mark, Shawn grabs Brett's legs to lock in the sharpshooter. Now, Brett was supposed to reverse it, pushing Shawn's leg off and rolling him onto his back, something that fans had grown in love to expect. That was all part of the sequence planned in Brett's mind. But as soon as Shawn got the hold secure, referee Earl Hebner jumped to his feet, looked at the timekeeper, and yelled, "Ring the bell." And according to lore, the timekeeper was surprised and froze in shock, knowing how much this moment meant to Hart and probably being afraid of ruining it for him. To which McMahon would, you know, being ringside, barked saying the command, "Ring the effing bell." We start hearing ding, 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 and Shawn Michaels' theme music suddenly just starts blaring, and the ring announcer declared Shawn Michaels as the new WWF champion by submission. But Brett hadn't tapped, and the crowd seemed baffled, stunned, shocked, unsure of what happened, to the point that even on commentary, Jim Ross asked, "What happened?" And Bret Hart stood there, stunned for a moment, then spat directly in Vince McMahon's face in fury. Shawn Michaels hurried out of the ring with the belt, and at times looking as if he didn't know what was going on either. But we later found out he was in on it too. The cable TV broadcast ended abruptly, leaving viewers confused, but the fans in the arena knew exactly what had happened. Bret Hart had just been cheated out of his title in front of the hometown crowd. They could see it all over the fuming face of their fallen hero. Now, once the bell rang, Bret realized he'd been ambushed, and he started smashing cameras. He tore up ringside equipment, and he even started spelling out WCW with his fingers to the camera, signaling where he was headed next. Now, once the fans in Montreal noticed the WCW, chants erupted with bullshit. They pelted the ring with debris as Brett's brother and fellow wrestler Owen tried to console him. This was more than the usual storyline betrayal. This felt like a real slap in the face, not just to Bret Hart, not just to Canadian fans, but to Bret Hart fans, WWF fans, all together. And backstage, the tensions had hit a boiling point. Vince McMahon had locked himself in his office, very well knowing what was coming. Bret had confronted Shawn, demanding to know if Shawn had been in on it. Shawn had said, and I quote, "My hands are clean," as he claimed at the time, following the script he was given to deny his involvement. And if fans remember, you can even watch this moment on Bret Hart's documentary that he was doing, because this was all filmed at the time on Bret Hart's end. And eventually, Bret found McMahon, confronted him, and famously punched him, with witnesses like Gerald Briscoe and Pat Patterson and Shane McMahon in on that same documentary that Bret was filming during this time. You can even say where he knocks Vince McMahon out. Knocked him out. People in Vince's party say Vince sprained his ankle and got a concussion when he went down. Bret just simply says, "I knocked him out." And Bret's wife at the time can even be seen scolding Triple H, who had his hands in the betrayal. And she tells them that they should all be ashamed of themselves. Now, at this time, many wrestlers sympathized with Bret. You had The Undertaker, who was furious. Mick Foley, a.k.a. Mankind, even boycotted the next night of WWF Raw in protest, only returning after the company reached out to him personally to woo him back. Rumors had spread half the locker room was ready to walk out, but Bret encouraged wrestlers to stay, not to risk losing their jobs over him. And the backstage environment was never the same after that night. The following night in Ottawa, the WWF was back to their regularly scheduled Monday Night Raw. Shawn Michaels came out bragging about beating Bret with his own move, the sharpshooter. And Vince McMahon later gave a televised interview with Jim Ross, trying to justify what happened. And in that interview, we heard that iconic line, "Vince McMahon didn't screw Bret Hart. I truly believe Bret Hart screwed Bret Hart." And that phrase stuck, and it turned Vince from a somewhat neutral authority figure into a despised on-screen villain that we knew as Mr. McMahon. And this brought on even more thrill of a ride with the Attitude Era. However, Bret left for WCW almost immediately. Bret would leave the WWF for WCW in an emotional fallout, which left Bret very bitter to the WWF. And it left him bitter in his...
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This would continue when tragedy struck the Hart family on May 23rd, 1999, when Bret's brother Owen, who had remained with the WWF after Bret's departure to WCW and was one of the WWF's newest stars, fell to his death while being lowered into the ring via a harness and a grapple line. At the time, McMahon made the decision not to cancel the remainder of the show and didn't tell the live audience that Owen had died. Meanwhile, Owen's friends, fellow wrestlers, had to go perform in the ring that was stained with his blood with the knowledge that he had died from the fall. I'm sure, as you can imagine, Bret was heartbroken, furious at the disrespect shown to his brother. Decades later, Bret would even say for a time he was so messed up from being betrayed for a few years earlier that he wondered if Owen's death could have been intentional, a way to get at him. After a few years, a lawsuit settlement, and a lengthy police investigation, it was determined that the manufacturer of the harness system was at fault, and it had nothing to do with WWF being negligent or reckless. The next blow to Bret Hart's career would come December 19th, 1999. And that was, "Whatever you do, don't hurt me." Direct quote from Bret Hart to Bill Goldberg as they were set to clash at the main event at WCW Starrcade. This is where the kick around the world was heard when Goldberg seemingly botched a super kick to Bret Hart. Bret Hart talks about it in his book, And he has this to say. I fired Goldberg into the ropes, and as he reversed me, I heard him call, "Watch the kick." I had no idea what kind of kick he meant, and there wasn't much room coming off the ropes. Goldberg's foot flew right under my right hand. Wham! The kick, unfortunately, would lead to lifelong consequences for the hitman. As Brett continues in his book, it felt like someone chopped me with a hockey stick. It was an agonizing blow that sent me crashing to the mat, where I was holding my neck just behind my right ear at the base of my skull. After the kick in the head, Brett remembered nothing. He just remembered thinking, I've got to get up for the finish, but I can't remember what it is. Regrettably, people with concussions are the last ones to figure out how badly hurt they are. Brett talked about it, saying, I was more responsible than anyone for downplaying my condition to myself and everyone else. I let myself go on, believing that the problem was a sore neck. I drifted through every day in a pale-faced, sweaty, head-pounding stupor, pacified to the point of numbness by the 4 Advils I took every 3 hours. After his match with Goldberg, Brett flew home to Calgary to visit NHL concussion specialist Dr. William Mius. And he says, I sat down in the doctor's office in Calgary. He noticed that I was slurring my words. The doctor said, I can feel a hole in the back of your neck the size of a quarter. Brett says he felt around the back of my skull. There is a part here that feels like hamburger. I hate to be the one to have to tell you this, but your career is probably over. And I do want to point out to everybody that even after the match, Brett was unaware of how bad the injury was, and Hart continued to compete in matches in the days that followed. And Wood Hart would later be diagnosed with post-concussion syndrome. He had to relinquish his title on January 16th of 2000. And later that year, due to the post-concussion syndrome, Bret Hart would retire from professional wrestling altogether. Now, Bret Hart and his feelings towards Bill Goldberg are no secret, and it is well documented. We are sitting here 26 years later, and Bret Hart is still throwing shade at Bill Goldberg. And his latest comments towards Goldberg were coming off of this weekend at Ontario's VaughnCon. And this is what he had to say. My personal feeling about professional wrestling today is that the wrestlers today, for the most part, are actors pretending to be wrestlers. Nobody puts a hold on. No one has what used to call wrestling psychology anymore, where they work on a leg or work on pinning your opponent. There's no strategy to what I learned in wrestling, where you tell a story to try and make things as real and believable as you can. The real art form is to never injure anybody. 2 wrestlers go out there, tell their story, and come back. I think it's still the case today. The first thing they do when they come back to the dressing room is they hug, shake hands, look at each other and go, I'm okay, nothing hurt, I didn't break my neck or anything, You didn't knock all my teeth out. You're just so happy that you go out there and give the performance. The real art is to not hurt anyone. Unfortunately, Bill Goldberg never got that memo. That is the most recent shot 26 years later, folks. But this is also the same person who seemingly ended Bret Hart's career. But Bret also wrestled 9 more matches into January 2000. And his last match in WCW was actually against Kevin Nash. And for what it's worth, ladies and gentlemen, WWF, in turn, when Bret left, Shawn became the top guy. And he goes to WCW, where guys like Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Hulk Hogan are the top guys. And Bret had previous issues with guys like Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, as they were part of the clique in the WWF locker room. And in the clique DVD, Bret Hart even spoke on there. So this is what he had to say about the clique being in WWF. They were literally a cancer in the dressing room. All of them. I don't doubt that Shawn Michaels is sorry for a lot of that kind of behavior. Kevin Nash was a great wrestler and a good guy, but I don't think he could be that proud of that association. It was a cancerous environment in the dressing room with those guys, and they certainly did more negative than positive to the business. Scott Hall. All you have to do is just look at him. He's a train wreck with his own life. He was a malcontent, or a guy that when you were close to him long enough, you start to feel the same way he did. You just felt so self-destructive and unhappy with your life and your job and everything. He was a guy that was infectious with his bad sort of moods and unhappiness in his own life, that it would spread to all the other wrestlers. And you know, I'm glad I'm not remembered for that kind of stuff. I'm remembered. I think if you talk to different wrestlers from that era, the Savio Vega and those kinds of wrestlers that were on my cards, they're all pretty proud of how I conducted myself, how I related to them, and how I may have been the top guy, but I didn't act like a superstar. Not to my friends, not to my peers. So, in that quote, Bret Hart thinks very, very highly of himself. And don't worry, because Scott Hall had his own opinion on Bret Hart. And his opinion changed when he went to Bret Hart's house. And Scott Hall talks about it, saying on a podcast, I believe, it was called In Your Head Radio. So he's on In Your Head Radio, and he tells a story about Bret Hart. And I'm going to read it. I'll never forget one time we were wrestling up in Calgary, and Bret had everyone over to his house, which is really kind of him, because a lot of guys don't want a bunch of wrestlers around their family. Like, nah, this is where I draw the line. I don't want a bunch of jocks hanging around my house. But Bret has everyone over, and I gotta admit, I love Bret, but when I left his house, I didn't feel the same about him. I'm just a different cat from Bret. I ain't saying I'm any better, I ain't saying I'm any worse, but Bret's house is a shrine to the Hitman. I mean, there wasn't a room in Bret's house that didn't have a picture of him in his wrestling gear. He was married back then to his lady, and he had babies with.
Above his bed was a portrait of Brett in a Sergeant Pepper jacket.
First to accept a Hall of Fame induction in 2006. You know, pink
with the tassels on.
Then he appeared on WWF.
I mean,
TV
I ain't saying it wasn't cool. I'm just saying, whoa,
it
bro.
It took him a few years to shake
off. Over your bed, are you ribbing me?
From that night in Montreal, and to come with terms with the death of his brother Owen. During that time, he would also reconcile with Vince McMahon, owner of the WWE, and he would reconcile with Shawn Michaels. Now, we know that Bret Hart has always targeted Goldberg. However, there are others throughout the years that he has targeted, such as Eric Bischoff, Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, and even current superstars like Seth Rollins and Gunther. Gunther was an on-air for stunt purposes that brought Bret in, only for down the line to have a match be made between Gunther and Goldberg. However, recently Hulk Hogan had passed away. And while on the Masked Man show, Bret Hart was asked about Hogan's passing and shared some moments, but ultimately had to bring in Eric Bischoff and, well, I'll let you be the judge in what you think of the comments. Hulk was a great guy and a great star. I got along really good with Hulk for years. I was one of his first matches. I helped make him from day one, and the only move he knew how to do was a bear hug. I remember going out there and making him. I was a young guy. I was happy to do it for him. I was good friends with Hulk. I was in Japan with him. In WWF, I always worked his undercards. I had so much respect for him, and he was always a friend to me. He was on top from 84 to 94. That's a long time wearing the crown. I will always shake my head and wonder why he was a roadblock for me. He wouldn't do anything for me. He made sure, and I know this for a fact, he made sure when I was in WCW that they didn't do anything for me. Don't do anything with him. Just leave him. Let him sit on the bench in the dressing room. WCW would fly me down in first class. First class rental car, first class hotel, and when I got to the building, they would tell me I was off and I would just fly home. That's how stupid they were. They were stupid bunch of idiots. Eric Bischoff was an absolute moron. I can't say anything about WCW and how stupid they were. They were the dumbest idiots I had any involvement with, said Hart. And when Bret talked about Hulk Hogan and passing away, this is what Bret said. You can never deny what Hulk Hogan did. His footprint in the wrestling business will always be huge. Maybe as big as it is ever going to get. When Hulk Hogan left WWF in 1992 and wasn't at SummerSlam 92, it was WrestleMania 8. When I fought Rowdy Piper. Piper was the one of the few guys that reached down and pulled me up to his level. I want to wrestle Bret Hart because I want to make him. Rowdy Piper made me and contributed to the next generation. There were a lot of wrestlers who didn't do that. Hulk Hogan never did that for anybody.
never pulled anybody else up. Jake Roberts never did anything for anybody else. Only did for Jake Roberts. I look at Jake Roberts and Hulk Hogan, and that's just two guys. Hulk Hogan, when I got to WWF in 1984, there was a smorgasbord of bad guys like Piper, Orndorff, Bob Orton, Kamala, Killer Khan, King Kong Bundy. It was like a candy box. He had such a lineup of guys to work with, the best villains in wrestling, that all made Hulk Hogan. Same with Jake Roberts, Ricky Steamboat, and Macho Man. They never lost. They got their hands raised. 1992 comes along, and they're going to give me this big push. There's nobody there and nobody left. I didn't have anybody to work with when I won the belt, really. Not any monsters, anyway. That's what I will always think. 1992. The elevator falling to the bottom. Everything was sinking so fast. They were in trouble. Hogan was off and on the steroid scandal. Though he said he never took them. All of that hurt the business. Hulk's shtick was getting tiring at that point. I don't know how I got picked. I never had any say. When I found out I was going to be the world champion, I was the first to find out, and it was a shock. I didn't expect it, but I was grateful for it. I always felt like things were falling so bad and Vince had to figure it out. Had to figure something. Stick it on him. I was a safe bet. I wasn't a guy who was going to get busted for having a couple ounces of coke in my bag like Jake Roberts might have. I wasn't the guy who was going to fail a drug test. I was a safe bet. That's why Vince picked me to be the champion. I need somebody who's not going to drop the ball and have any scandals. I can't take any more scandals. Stick it on Bret Hart. So they stuck it on me. I wasn't expecting it. But I stepped up to the plate. I always thought that day that I won the belt, Hulk Hogan would come up and pat me on the back and tell me how glad he was that I was the guy they picked to pull the sword out of the stone for him. Unfortunately, that's not how it was. The second I won the belt, I was an enemy. I had what he wanted, and we were never really friends ever again. That had nothing to do with me. I was always honest. Hulk, it was like a little kid in elementary school. Some kids were bullshitters who tell bullshit. Classic bullshitters. Sometimes you have kids like that. I think Hulk Hogan was a bullshitter. In Bret's most recent complaint, as he has complained about WWE and the way he's been treated over the years, his most recent had to do with SummerSlam. And this is what he had to say. And this is him, an issue that had occurred. I went to SummerSlam. They invited me down this year for WWE and told me they wanted me to be in the crowd. They told me once I got there they didn't have any seats. But I noticed Kevin Nash got a seat. So I just sort of... No, I finally realized that they don't fully appreciate me. Even after Hulk's passing, there's no appreciation for anything I did. There's only three wrestlers left alive that were in the main event wrestlers in the first 10 WrestleMania. Sergeant Slaughter is one, the Million Dollar Man is the other one. I'm not planning on going anywhere for at least another 30 years. So Bret was upset that WWE invited him down and that at SummerSlam they ultimately told him that they didn't have a seat for him. But Kevin Nash did respond to Bret's comments on his show, Click This, saying, I saw where he was pissed because he went to SummerSlam and was told that they would have a seat for him, and there wasn't, but I got a seat. Well, number one, I didn't go to the show because I knew I didn't have a seat. I guess my name got brought up. It would be, oh, Triple H's buddy got a effing seat. I called Brett. I said, I stopped going after they put me in a effing box, and the monitor in the box didn't work, and the ring was so effing small, we were so far away, we had to watch, like, look up and watch the Tron. Like, with no announcing. I will say this, that Kevin Nash did not blame or hold any remorse towards Brett name-dropping him like that. But that was one of the complaints recently from Bret Hart. And it's brought up a lot of controversy, or at least it's brought up enough wrestlers to complain about it, as Big Vito had a message for Bret Hart. Enough. How long can we hear you, bitch? That's all you do now. You were looked up to as a great wrestler. Technician, a guy I modeled my wrestling after. I was so proud to wrestle you, be in the same company as you. But this, years of just complaining, years of bitching and moaning. You have every right to be pissed off about things, but it's time to stop. Who the hell wants to hear it anymore? It's Goldberg, it's Hogan, it's Vince. Who else can we complain about? You get paid to appear, and you still bitch. Kevin Nash got a seat. I think I just threw up. You may have become someone that people can't stand to listen to anymore. And Big Vito would continue, as he would say, but bitching with money in the bank? You're treated like royalty. And you treat people like shit. You still get paid by the WWE, and you're still complaining. How about this? Take your ball and go the F home. It's been said. Finally, someone has spoken. It's me. Now go have a miserable day. The best there was at bitching, the best there ever will be at bitching, and one last thing, the best there ever will be at bitching. The Don has spoken. And with that last comment, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to leave this up to you. You, the fans, can decide in the comment sections at youtube.com/perchedonthetoprope. You can also in the comment sections at facebook.com/perchedonthetoprope. You can also leave comments when we post this on Instagram at Perched on the Top Rope Podcast, Threads, Perched on the Top Rope Podcast, anywhere and everywhere social media, X and Blue Sky at Perch Top Rope. Is Bret Hart bitter, or is Bret Hart right? Ladies and gentlemen, spoiler freeze, the way to be. I'm out.
If If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.